Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. It's another very hot summer, and New Mexico's shrinking supply of water is again a very hot topic. Consider just these three things. We are in the midst of an extreme drought. Albuquerque, for example, has had less than 1 inch of rain since September. Two, water allocations are oversubscribed, and the Rio Grande itself is on life support. And three, climate change is expected to only make all these matters worse. Joining me to talk about how we got here and what, if anything, we can do about it is renowned water expert Dr. Fred Phillips, director of the hydrology program at New Mexico Tech and author of the recent book, Raining in the Rio Grande. Dr. Fred Phillips, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Phillips, later in the show, I'd like to talk about our policy options going forward, but let's get started with how we got here. In your book, two personalities really come forward to me, and that's New Mexico State Engineer Steve Reynolds, who helped to rein in the Rio Grande, and Letty Boleyn, whose client, the Silvery Meadow, she advocated for in terms of trying to keep the river wet. But let's start with Steve Reynolds, really an extraordinary guy who had an extraordinary impact on New Mexico water.
That's certainly correct.
Do you want to tell me a little bit about Steve Reynolds?
Steve Reynolds was a graduate of the University of New Mexico, graduated with a mechanical engineering degree there, and he ended up as an atmospheric electricity researcher, and then, rather strangely, was called by the governor of the state to become the state engineer in charge of water resources. And even though his background would have seemed a pretty poor preparation, for what he did, he was, without question, the most renowned state engineer that New Mexico ever had.
And he was a bright guy, right? First in his class at UNM and captain of the football team and had it.
President of the student body?
President of the student body.
That's right.
So he wasn't just anyone.
No, he was not. And he was a brilliant researcher, although he was not doing applied research in water resources at all. He was in a completely different area. But nevertheless, he was able to turn around the knowledge that he had garnered there into being the most effective administrator of water resources New Mexico ever saw.
I said that Steve Reynolds had a lot to do with reining in the Rio Grande, but actually had already been done to rein in the Rio Grande before he took over in 1955, correct?
That's correct. Probably the most important things were the irrigation projects that were developed by the Bureau of Reclamation, especially Elephant Butte Dam, and then the conservancy districts, or which are really irrigation districts, that built the infrastructure that distributes the water.
And yet, now when Reynolds comes in, he faces some enormous problems, one of which is that there was also an interstate compact entered into, I think, in 1939 that was based on supposedly 1929 water usage of the three relevant states.
That's correct.
And New Mexico wasn't doing very well on getting water to Texas and wasn't doing very well on getting enough water to Mexico. And one of the things that Reynolds really couldn't figure out was why this was true, because even in wet years, even in years where there was a lot of snowpack runoff and a lot of rain, we still didn't do very well in doing that.
That's correct.
So, you know, he begins to think about this, and why don't you explain to me what he came up with?
Well, he came up with several things, but one of the most radical ones and the most significant insight was that he realized that the connection between groundwater and pumping of groundwater and the surface water in the Rio Grande was a key component of the equation. And basically, high-capacity pumps had been developed in about the 30 years prior to his taking the job of state engineer, and those pumps were lowering the water level of the groundwater around the Rio Grande, causing the flow to reverse and water to come out of the river and go into the wells. And therefore, even though all the surface water diversions and so on were being managed properly, it was like a siphon that was sucking the water out of the Rio Grande. He realized that, and he proclaimed regulations that limited the amount of pumping that could be done in a fairly sophisticated kind of way to cause this balance to be redressed.
I have to say, I don't quite understand this. Albuquerque was sitting supposedly on this aquifer that was the size of Lake Erie that wasn't
right.
Connected to the river. And so how did the pumping of this from this huge aquifer, How would that affect the ground, the water in the river?
Well, there's a couple of misconceptions there. One is that the aquifer was nowhere near of the size that early hydrologists had predicted it would be or had thought it would be. It's, in fact, much more limited. The second one is...
Well, let's stop right there. How limited is it?
The best aquifer materials, the ones that are highly conductive of water and that have good quality water in them, are in a fairly narrow zone around the Rio Grande. And if we're going to talk about it in terms of, you know, Lake Erie volumes, it's maybe a tenth or less of, you know, the volume of Lake Erie.
So it was way off.
Yes.
Okay. So let's get to this pumping question, because I thought the aquifer was unconnected to the
right.
river.
Right. And so...
So did a lot of other people.
A lot of other people did as well. But, I mean, the most perceptive early hydrologists, the head of the U.S. Geological Survey here in New Mexico in that period, Charles V. Tice, was very aware of the connection between the aquifer and the river. And, in fact, they are intimately connected. There is little barrier between the two. And so if you have a well that's close to the river, within a few years, all of the water, 100% of the water that is coming out of the well is coming from the river.
Now, one of the interesting things I read in your book was that even if you have a well that's pretty far away from the river, eventually all that water also comes from the river.
That's correct. It takes a longer time, a significantly longer time, to establish that steady state condition where it's getting all the water out of the river. But it does happen.
So Reynolds realizes all that and declares the Rio Grande Valley a water basin, and now you have to go to the state engineer to pump. Is that how it works?
Yes. The critical thing is you have to get a permit from the state engineer to drill your well and pump it. And in order to get that permit, you have to buy up surface water rights to counter the amount of water that you're going to suck out of the river.
So you have to buy offsets, in effect.
Correct.
Interesting. And that's all Reynolds. So that's sort of good for the river.
That's right. And, in fact, Reynolds was that type of policy is very common over much of the United States now. And it was introduced here in New Mexico by Steve Reynolds in the 1950s.
Now, one of the big things that Reynolds comes up with, which is another good thing, which is he comes up with additional water. This is the thing. This is the dream of all New Mexicans. Why can't we come up with additional water? He actually did it.
That's right. So he managed to, he didn't do it by himself, but he was a key mover in a coalition that got the federal right to divert water under the Continental Divide from the Colorado River system into the Chama River and from thence down into the Rio Grande. So that's, yes, this is the ultimate dream, to import water from outside of your own drainage basin, and he's one of the few who accomplished
it. And this is the so-called San Juan Chama Diversion Project.
Correct.
And by the way, just while we're on that, I mean, a lot of people would like to see us get more water from some other source. Is there any realistic chance of that happening?
None.
None. Okay. That's pretty definitive. Now, there's a lot of things that Reynolds did that people don't particularly care for anymore, one of which is channelizing the river.
That's correct. He realized that part of the reason that we were not able to deliver as much water to Elephant Butte Reservoir as we were supposed to was that a lot of it was being used up by vegetation along the river. And so by taking the meandering river and putting it in between narrow channels with not much room for vegetation, he cut down a lot on that usage of water.
So he basically destroys the original habitat of the river.
Yes, he destroys the riparian ecosystem in order to achieve the goal of mandated water deliveries.
And he begins to achieve that, right? Now, under Reynolds, we start not only not being in a deficit, we start catching up, correct?
That's correct. And if you look at the graph that shows you the cumulative balance or imbalance in the water deliveries to Elephant Butte Reservoir, what you see is that in about the 15 years prior to Reynolds, the water debt built up and up and up almost every year, got larger and larger. And then once Reynolds became state engineer, it starts going down. And in fact, it did not go back to New Mexico having paid off its water debt until about the time that Reynolds died in office. It took a very long time. But that pivotal tip when it goes from increasing debt to decreasing debt is pretty much the day that Reynolds was selected as state engineer.
So if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. We're talking about New Mexico's water shortage today with a true expert in the field, among other things, the director of the hydrology program at New Mexico Tech, and also the author of the recent book, Raining in the Rio Grande. Now, as I mentioned, not everyone thought that Reynolds was doing such a great job, and one of the awards he gets, which he said he was most proud of, was Earth Enemy of the Year in 1980.
Yes.
So another person who's kind of agreed with this characterization of Reynolds as an Earth Enemy, and who I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the top of the show, was Letty Boleyn. And she becomes a very famous or infamous in New Mexico water history. And why don't you tell us a little bit about Letty Boleyn?
Well, Letty Boleyn did some research on the flow in the Rio Grande and the laws governing it, and she became convinced that the state should have laws that viewed in-stream uses of water as beneficial. In other words, in order to be a legitimate use of water in the state, it has to be deemed a beneficial use, and water simply flowing down the bed of the river, i.e. a wet river, is not considered beneficial under New Mexico law, unlike most other western states. New Mexico is really an anomaly. And so in order to try and force the question, she filed a lawsuit saying that the Rio Grande silvery minnow was an endangered species, and by not keeping the river wet, the prospects for the minnow surviving were greatly diminished, and therefore water had to be provided for the minnow. So this was sort of a de facto way of getting in-stream flows.
Yeah, your book really tells a good story about her, because she's this California water lawyer who comes to New Mexico, recognizes that New Mexico's law is inconsistent with that of the other western states. She's an assistant AG under now Senator Tom Udall, and she writes this opinion saying, you know, there's no reason why New Mexico can't have the same law as every other place. But the opinion really goes nowhere, right?
That's right. And in fact, there's never been any truly serious attempt to get that instituted as a part of New Mexico water law.
I'm a lawyer, and we all say the practice of law would be great except for the clients. Well, she finds the perfect client, which is a 2-inch minnow, right, who can't complain about her work or talk back to her or do anything. And that minnow ends up being the perfect avatar for her contentions, right?
That's right. At least the superficial perspective is highly successful. And so it results in a whole series of changes in the way that the river is managed, greatly to the consternation of almost all of the parties who have to actually supply the water. And
yeah, it was a total shock, right, Fred?
Yes.
Because, first of all, the case is in front of James Parker, a federal judge, a Reagan appointee, and they think he's the last one who's going to grant these rights to the minnow and literally take water away from Albuquerque in the middle of Rio Grande, a conservancy district, and give them to the minnow. No one thought that would happen.
That's right, and that's exactly what he does, and very emphatically, too.
And the thing is, and I sort of became a little intrigued with it, it's not as absolutely as clear-cut as that, because first of all, there was a lot of work that went into getting the San Juan Chama water diverted, right? And it was all by the feds.
That's correct.
And the feds actually, in the authorizing legislation for it, talk about specifically preserving wildlife species and fish. So, and under the Endangered Species Act, which the minnow was listed under, right, her contention was, you know, you're responsible, you own this stuff, you're supposed to be preserving wildlife and fish, how can you not preserve this endangered minnow that in 1996, there was this huge die-off, right, in 1996?
That's right. Right at the time that they were spawning, they cut the water off in the river, and so very few of the, I mean, the fish only lives 1 year. So, you know, if it doesn't successfully spawn, then the population drops drastically. And that's what happened.
So her contention is, look, I mean, you know, under the Endangered Species Act, this species is about to go.
That's right.
And one of the things your book points out is a lot of species had already gone, right?
Oh, and in fact, the Rio Grande used to be home to something like 15 species of fish, including the gar, a fish that's about 10 feet long, and migrated all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico and then back up to the Rio Grande to lay its eggs. So it was an unimaginably different river than it is today.
So as you said, she's very successful in this lawsuit. She gets all these injunctions, but the city, Governor Richardson, Senator Domenici, the state of New Mexico, they're all outraged by this, right?
That's right. They all hate her.
And they decide to do something about her, right?
In what sense do you mean?
Well, they pass these riders to the appropriation bills,
right,
saying that the Endangered Species Act will not apply in this circumstance.
That's correct.
So everything she'd won, in essence, gets wiped out.
To a certain extent, that's true.
But somehow, now, this is the part I don't quite understand. She's still able to negotiate a result after these riders are put into effect that really improves the river at least somewhat, correct?
Yes. I mean, Judge Parker did something that was very interesting, and that was that he did not try to come up with a resolution that would protect the silvery minnow by fiat. But rather, he ordered all of the parties involved, he basically locked them up into a room and told them that they had to come up with a management plan that would at least attempt to provide enough water that the minnow would have a hope. And that was done. And in fact, I think that today most of those people and most of those parties that sat down to do those negotiations are fairly sympathetic toward the minnow, and they consider it to be one of their goals to try their best, at any rate, to make sure that there's enough water for the minnow to survive from year to year.
Which means there's more water in the river than there would have been absent this litigation.
That's right. I mean, this year in particular, the agreement was that, in fact, there's probably not going to be enough water except for very minimal for the minnow. And they're essentially banking on these minnows that are in engineered refugia to repopulate the river after what's going to be a catastrophe this year. But everybody kind of agrees, well, there's not a whole lot we can do about it because water is so short this year.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name's Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to be talking with Dr. Fred Phillips, who, among other things, is the author of Reining in the Rio Grande. Now, Fred, I'd really like to turn to what your last answer kind of suggested, which is, what do we do now? And just for people who have just joined us, just let me mention, our water supply is shrinking. We're in a seemingly endless drought. Water rights are oversubscribed. We have a growing population. We have a struggling ag industry. Global climate change is supposed to make everything worse. And we're a very poor state, 50th in child welfare. So what do we do, Fred? Where should policy go?
A place that I like to start in thinking about this is with regard to Reynolds planning for the future in terms of the groundwater surface water interaction. There is this period of time when you can pump from wells that are distant from the river and get water out of groundwater storage without affecting the river. And that period ended sometime about 10 years ago. And so now we are in this situation where pretty much every drop of water that you pump out of the aquifer is coming out of the river. And so what that means is then the last buffer is gone. And at this point, any new use for water has to be taken from somebody who's already using water. It's a zero-sum game. And so to me, this brings up the question of what do we want to do with that water? You know, it isn't water for free. The last of the water for free is gone.
So one idea I have is to do it like we do any other scarce resource and put a user fee on water. And most people don't understand that water in New Mexico is essentially free. I mean, the cost of getting it to somebody or the cost of cleaning it so you can drink it, you have to pay for that. But the water itself is free, and with a scarce resource, to me, that makes no sense.
Okay. To me, that brings up the question of, okay, what about the trees in the bosque, right? Are the trees in the bosque going to pay for the water that they use? If they can't, then how do we justify letting them have water? Do we kill them all off? Do we just, you know, spray it all with herbicide because that will increase the usage? So I think really in front of that kind of policy that you're talking about, which certainly has its place, we need to consider the question of what do we ultimately want to do with the water that we have? The water that we, you know, the water is the limiting resource for New Mexico. And so if it's our limiting resource and it's a zero-sum game in sharing it around, then where do we want to end up with it? To me, I think we need to have a conversation about that before we put into place policies that change the way that the water is going to be used.
Okay, so that brings up my second idea, which is, finish these water adjudications. I mean, most people are probably completely unaware of these large water adjudications that are determining people's rights. And why don't you just describe those for a second?
So New Mexico operates under the prior appropriation system, and a key part of that system is that when there is a water shortage, there is supposed to be something called priority administration, where the people who have the most junior water right, the most recently acquired water right, are cut off. And it's cut off going up the ladder in terms of the date of their water right until the most senior people in the end up getting all of the water. They get their full allocation while everybody else is cut off. However, in order to do that, you have to know who has the oldest water right, who has the youngest. And the legal process for establishing that is called adjudication. It's been done in many small river basins in New Mexico. It's never been done in the Rio Grande because it's such a huge problem. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of water rights. And so the process of establishing their precedence is a mind-bogglingly huge one.
So the idea would be if we could finish these adjudications, then there could be, we could set up water markets, there could be water transfers. The state, for example, could buy water and protect the trees, protect the river. But as you say, you can't buy something or lease something if you don't know exactly what it is you're buying or leasing.
That is correct. But I mean, I think in terms of the activities that you are talking about, the exact precedence of the water right is not so critical. The place that the precedence is critical is in priority administration. And in fact, most people are reluctant, it turns out. When push comes to shove, they're reluctant to implement priority administration. One very, you know, immediate practical result of this is, for example, the water rights held by the city of Albuquerque are for the most part fairly junior water rights. And so under a condition like we have right now, one of the things that would happen would be that farmers in various places where they have old water rights would be getting their full amount of water for growing alfalfa or whatever it is, and the city of Albuquerque would be cut down to, say, half of its current usage because it would be cut off under the priority administration.
So I guess I don't quite understand, because doesn't Albuquerque have a priority on the San Juan Chama diversion water?
Yeah, but that's only a small part of its water supply.
I see.
So personally, I am not a big fan of the outcomes of priority administration. I think that was a method for administration of water that kind of made sense at the beginning of the 20th century. I don't think it makes much sense in the 21st century, and I think that we should look to alternative means of administering water.
Yeah, but the problem is the law follows this priority administration idea, right?
Okay, it is a dilemma. Because, in fact, there has never been a call on the Middle Rio Grande. And so in spite of the fact that that's in the Constitution of the state of New Mexico, it has never been implemented or followed. So we sort of have a choice of keeping on the books a nominal set of laws that we don't follow and we probably would feel was a disaster if they were followed, or of trying to actually change the Constitution and come up with a different set of water laws. It's pretty much between a rock and a hard place.
The third idea I'd like to talk to you about is simply to try to promote more efficiency, particularly in agriculture. You know, as I understand it, about 80% of New Mexico's water is used in agriculture.
That's
But 60% of New Mexico is farmland, but 90% of that is pasture land. So the real high users are the crop growers, not the dairy and cattle industry, which is really our primary industries. So would there be some way to incent the high water users to to change or to sell their water rights, et cetera, et cetera? Economic incentives to go to drip irrigation, economic incentives to switch to a less thirsty crop, something like that.
I mean, certainly there are economic incentives to sell water rights, and water rights are increasingly being sold from agricultural uses to municipal and industrial ones. So that process is well underway, and in fact, if it continues on its present path, the problem is going to be sort of, quote, solved by not having any agriculture along the Rio Grande in 50 or something like that years. So I don't know if that's a place that we want to end up or not. In terms of the incentives to be more conserving in the use of water, I mean, I think that that's a matter of economic return, right? If farmers can put in technology or different crops or whatever that will enable them to use less water and thereby make more money out of it somehow, they'll certainly do that now. If they're not going to make more money out of it, then are you talking about subsidies?
Yeah.
That is, that's something that could be considered, yes. I'm not sure how welcome that would be among the agricultural community, but maybe it would be. I guess one would have to look at the details of it. That certainly is an option that I would say is one that we should look at.
So we're nearing the end of the show, so let me ask you the bottom line question, which is, how much do you think New Mexico's future is going to be impacted by water scarcity, in what ways?
First of all, I don't think that we are likely to find ourselves in the foreseeable future, our lifetimes, in a situation where you turn on the tap and nothing comes out. But what we are going to see is the shift in the environment around us. And so the environment around us is going to become dominated by suburbs and the actual river itself, the riparian woodlands around the river and the agricultural areas are going to become brown belts. If you want to look at where we are headed now, go to Phoenix. That is our path for the future. And you can go to the Salt River. Salt River is just a sort of a sandy streak there with no vegetation along it. So, do we want to become another Phoenix? That's the question New Mexicans need to ask themselves.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. I'd like to thank my guest so much, Dr. Fred Phillips. Thanks also to my producer, Joe Green. Special thanks to my friend, Dan Stevens. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. My name is Stephen Spitz. Podcasts of this show are available on iTunes under Stephen Spitz. Archives of all my past shows are available at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.